Well, I'm really delighted here this morning to be able to introduce Ray, who's going to, I think, really delight us. Every time I've heard him, I always leave with new insights. But before I introduce Ray, I just want to make a couple of comments. You know, I think the mentoring sessions that we've had this morning, I've been talking to a lot of the younger entrepreneurs. And one of the things that sort of comes up is that sometimes, you know, they have the passion, they want to get going, but things don't always go the right way. And a lot of the people sort of really feel like the world is being unfair to them. And that's true. It's true that the world is unfair. But at the same time, whenever things are unfair, there's a victim and then there's a beneficiary, right? So when you really step back and look at the whole world as a whole, you realize that actually everybody in this room is probably on the beneficiary side. You know, the world has really been very good to pretty much everybody in this room. So I think it's good not to forget that perspective. You know, it's just like an entrepreneur is like an athlete. You know, you play a game, and sometimes the referee, you know, whistles and makes the wrong call. Either you can be a brat and sort of, you know, yell and scream and stop playing the game, or you can say, well, and then you move on and you continue to play the game. And so when you get a setback, I wouldn't worry about too much about it. I would be a good sport and move on. And sometimes when you play the game, you lose the game as well. And again, the same thing. You know, if you're a good player, if you really enjoy playing, you move on. You don't worry that much and you don't spend the rest of your life talking about how you lost a game. And in fact, if you really want to stay fit, if you want to do good things, you should be playing games where you're in the right league, where you win some and you lose some. It's no fun being in a league where you win every game in 3 sets and beat everybody 6-0, because then it just means that you're not fully using all your capabilities, in which case, you know, slowly your skills will deteriorate and you won't be as good an athlete anymore. And so a lot of times, you know, when you get opportunities to move from one league to another league, you should make sure that you grab that opportunity and go for it, as opposed to being scared about playing in a league where you may lose. And so with those couple of thoughts, I would like to leave you, because I think there's going to be lots of opportunities for almost every entrepreneur, every leader who wants to make a change. And that's what we're going to hear from Ray. You know, Ray has done a lot of deep thinking on these issues, and he's going to tell us how the world is going to change. And every time there's a change, it creates an opportunity for an entrepreneur and a leader to lead that change. And so I'm really delighted to have Ray here this morning. And Ray has been described as the restless genius, the ultimate thinking machine, and actually, more than anything else, a rightful heir to Thomas Edison. Because he's not only a thinker, but actually he's done stuff. You know, he was the first inventor of a CCD flat panel bed scanner. He was the first person to come up with an omnipoint optical character recognition machine. He was the first one to actually do text-to-speech synthesizer, the first music synthesizer, and the first commercially available large vocabulary speech recognition machine. And of course, Ray has been widely recognized, and he's a recipient of the $500,000 MIT Levinson Prize, which is sort of like a Nobel Prize for engineers. He's been the National Medal, recipient of the National Medal of Technology, which is an honor given to the person by the President of the United States. He's inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame, and he's received, I thought it was 12, but actually last week he received another one. So he's received 13 honorary doctorates from universities. He's written 5 books, and his latest book, Singularity is Near, is again another bestseller. You know, I've had the privilege of working with Ray, and I get to see him fairly often now because we are both on the board at MIT. And it's always good to talk to Ray, because you leave with a new insight. You know, he's one of the few guys who can zoom in all the way and talk about nanotechnology, and the very next minute he can zoom out and talk about the whole universe. He can talk about picoseconds, and he can also talk about how human beings have evolved over a million years. So I think it's always a real delight to have Ray and listen to him. So ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Ray Kurzweil.
I greatly value our growing friendship and relationship on multiple projects, and Deshaul always leaves me with provocative thoughts as well. It's a pleasure to share ideas with you this morning. It really is a flat, interrelated world. The engineers and entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, New England, India, China are creating value for all of us. It's not a zero-sum game. And the pace of innovation is increasing, and that's not a vague comment. That's actually something I've studied. I decided I would be an inventor when I was 5. Not sure why I made that decision. I think my parents left me in my playpen too long. But I did have that very confident expectation, and when other kids were saying they were going to be a fireman or a nurse, or I had this conceit that I knew what I was going to be. But I'd say about 30 years ago, I realized that really the key to inventing is not just getting the thing to work, but timing. And like Dash, I get a number of business plans, and we do some mentoring and angel investing. And I would say that 90% of the plans we get, those teams would do exactly what they say in terms of building a technology, if given the opportunity. But 95% of those projects would fail because the timing is wrong. Not all the enabling factors that are needed outside of their own project would not be in place at the right time, and they'd be too early or too late, miss the window of opportunity. And recognizing that, I became an ardent student of technology trends about 30 years ago and began to track technology trends and attempt to build models of how technology evolves. And being an engineer, I collected a lot of data and built mathematical models and developed an approach that's actually been quite accurate in being able to predict technology. And this sort of belies the common wisdom that you can't predict the future. And that's true for specific projects. If you ask me, you know, will the stock of Google be higher or lower than it is today 3 years from now, that's hard to say. And what will the next wireless standard be? CDMA, G3, WiMAX? That's hard to predict. But if you ask me how much will it cost for a base pair of DNA to sequence in 2010, or how much will the MIPS of computing be in 2012, or what will the spatial resolution and 3D volume be of brain scanning in 2014, I can give you a figure, and it's likely to be accurate. And I say this now not just backfitting the past data, but I've been making these forward-looking predictions for over a quarter century. And you might wonder how, and they've been quite accurate. For example, I predicted the emergence of a worldwide communication net, made the prediction in the mid-80s, that by the mid-90s there'd be this worldwide communication network tying together tens of millions of people, growing them to hundreds of millions. That seemed ridiculous in the mid-1980s because the ARPANET was tying together a few thousand scientists. I saw it go from 10,000 nodes to 20,000 in 1 year and then to 40,000. It was clear to me that doubling every year would continue. Doubling every year means multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years. So I felt it would be 10 million going to 20 million to 40 million to 80 million in the mid-1990s, and that's exactly what happened. But in the early 90s, people were saying, where is this worldwide communication net? I mean, we don't see it. It's the nature of exponential growth. It looks like nothing's happening when you're doubling these little numbers and then suddenly it takes off. And the pace of those new paradigm shifts is itself accelerating. You might wonder, how could this be? I mean, if we can't predict, you know, with any kind of reliability, a specific project, how can we make predictions about the overall impact of technology made up of a large number of unpredictable projects, unpredictable people? Well, we see other examples in science of this phenomena. The classical example is thermodynamics. That was really the first introduction of a complex system, actually in the 19th century. So, you know, the path of every particle, every molecule in a gas is completely unpredictable. It takes a random walk. Yet the overall properties of the gas, made up of a large number of unpredictable, chaotically interacting particles, it's very predictable. According to the laws of thermodynamics, to a very high degree of precision, so you can make reliable predictions about the overall impact of complex systems where each element is chaotic and random. And that's what we see in technology evolution. Technology is such a complex, dynamic system with millions of people and hundreds of thousands of projects and thousands of companies and dozens of countries all interacting in this very chaotic way with recessions and countries dumping products in another country and wars. Out of all that chaotic, unpredictable human activity comes very predictable trends. And I'm going to show you a few dozen of these. We have hundreds of examples. And you'll see just how not only dramatic the exponential growth is in price performance capacity, but how predictable and how smooth these trends are over decades, even over a century in the case of computation. And you can make reliable predictions about what will be feasible in 2 years, 4 years, 10 years, 20 years. And it used to be those changes were slow enough that you could basically ignore them. The world would be pretty much the same a few years hence. In fact, a few hundred years ago, people expected their grandchildren would live the same lives that they did. And those expectations were largely borne out until the Industrial Revolution, when the business model of the weavers was turned on its head and created the Luddite movement. And, you know, the idea of change first was introduced. And by the end of the 19th century, people had the idea that change was a constant. But actually, change is not a constant, because the pace of change is itself accelerating. So I want to come back to these thoughts, but just show you one example from my own work. Brought a new invention with me. In 2000, I've been involved in reading machines for 30 years. We introduced the first print-to-speech reading machine 30 years ago, which combined three new technologies, a flatbed scanner, OmniFont optical character recognition, and speech synthesis. And I've been actually continuously involved in reading machines for 30 years. So in 2001, we felt that within 5 years, by 2006, it'd be feasible to put a reading machine in a basically a pocket-sized device. The hardware would be available. We also felt it would take 5 years to develop. We had OCR and speech synthesis. There was an engineering task to put them in a pocket-sized machine. But the real key task was to be able to deal with the vagaries of getting images from a camera where you've got three different degrees of freedom of tilt and rotation, curved images, uneven illumination, and all kinds of problems that you don't have in the controlled environment of a scanner. And we felt that would take 5 years. So we started in 2001. If we started now, when the hardware first became available, in fact, people were skeptical. It seems obvious now that the hardware is available because it's available, but it didn't seem so obvious in 2001. But our models indicated it would be. And if we started now, we'd miss the window of opportunity. So I'll show you this latest example.
The system is on. Camera is off. I'm ready. Camera is on. Field of view report. Top and right edges are visible, 55% filled.
So this gives the blind person some feedback. Well, didn't see the left edge. So.
Field of view report. Top and left edges are visible. Taking picture.
So it'll give us progress reports, and it's got to adjust for rotation, tilt, the image is curved. If you look at it,
pre-processing picture.
You see the image come out curved, which OCR can't deal with. So it's got to straighten all that
out. Camera is 0 degrees clockwise relative to the page.
Okay, I actually nailed it at 0 degrees.
Page 1, GNR 289. The AI winter is long since over, and we are well into the spring of narrow AI. Most of the examples above were research projects just 10 to 15 years ago. If all the AI systems in the world suddenly stopped functioning, our economic infrastructure would grind to a halt. Your bank would cease doing business. Most transportation would be crippled. Most communications would fail. This was not the case a decade ago. Of course, our AI systems are not smart enough to organize such a conspiracy. Strong AI. If you understand something in only one way, then you don't really understand it at all. This is because, if something goes wrong, you get stuck with a thought that just sits in your mind with nowhere to go. This speaking canceled.
Yeah. So it's one example of trying to time your inventions. And this has actually taken a life of its own. I have a team of 10 people that methodically gathers data in many different fields, and then we build mathematical models about how technology evolves in all of these different areas. The primary application is to time my own technology projects, but it does have this side benefit of being able to basically make predictions about what will be feasible in broad areas of technology in many different fields. So I use that to make predictions about the future, and provides material for books. But we can really anticipate the impact of technology and what society will look like. And if anything, the future will be more remarkable than what we can predict today, because we'll have all of you and your colleagues and millions of other people around the world adding their own creative ideas to these very powerful, exponentially growing technological capabilities. And this exponential growth is not just computers, it's not just iPods, it's not just digital phones and cameras. It's really anything having to do with information, which ultimately will be everything we care about, including, for example, our health. Biology didn't used to be an information technology. It was basically hit or miss. We'd find something. Oh, here's something that lowers blood pressure. We don't know why this works, but it seems to work to some extent. But variably, we find these are crude tools. They have lots of side effects that we're finding with a lot of these drugs. 99% of the drugs in the market today were done this way, called drug discovery. We automated the discovery method, so we'd sort of methodically go through 10,000 compounds to find one, but which was not based on actually designing something, designing a tool to do a job, kind of similar to primitive man and woman's tool creation. They just find, oh, here's a stone, this would make a good hammer. We didn't have means to actually shape the tools. The paradigm now is rational drug design, to actually have a model of the information processes underlying disease and actually reprogram those processes away from disease, and we're gaining the tools to do that, and all of that's growing exponentially. The Genome Project was not a mainstream project when it was announced in 1990. Mainstream skeptics said, there's no way you're going to do this. In 1989, we just sequenced 1/10,000th of the genome with our most advanced equipment and our best PhD students. It'll take hundreds of years to do this. And halfway through the project, 7.5 years into the 15-year project, the skeptics were still going strong, saying, I told you this wasn't going to work. I mean, here you are halfway through the project and you finished 1% of the project. But if you double 1% 7 times, you get 100%, and that's exactly what happened, and that's continued since the completion of the Genome Project. It took us 15 years to sequence HIV. We sequenced SARS in 31 days. We can sequence a virus now in 7 days. So this is continuing. And we're gaining the means to actually reprogram these information processes. Biology is basically an information process. It starts with our genes. I mean, how much software do you have that you haven't changed in 30 weeks, let alone 30,000 years? Yet we have these 23,000 software programs inside us called genes, and they haven't changed much in thousands of years. And they evolved when conditions were quite different. So take, for example, the fat insulin receptor gene, which basically says, hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season may not work out so well. And that was a good strategy 1,000 years ago, because calories were few and far between. If you happened upon some calories, I mean, more likely you worked hard to get those calories, you wanted to store them, but there were no refrigerators. The only place to store them was in your body. In fact, the fat insulin receptor gene was the biological evolutionary innovation that allowed animals to roam around so they could carry their calories with them. Plants don't have a fat insulin receptor gene. That gene now underlies an epidemic of obesity, and we'd like to turn that gene off. So what would happen if we did that? That was tried not far from here at the Joslin Diabetes Center. These mice ate ravenously. They had their FIR gene turned off, and they remained slim, and it wasn't a fake slimness. They got the health benefits of being slim. They didn't get diabetes. They didn't get heart disease. They lived 20% longer. They got the health benefits of caloric restriction while doing the opposite. And 5 pharmaceutical companies have noticed, hey, that'd be a good drug for the human market. And there are 5 pharmaceutical companies rushing to bring fat insulin receptor gene inhibitors to the human market. The weight loss drugs on the market today basically work by inhibiting appetite, which is really not what we want. It's kind of like a birth control pill that works by inhibiting interest in sex. And that's just one of the 23,000 genes we'd like to turn off. There are other genes we've identified that are critical for atherosclerosis, the cause of heart attacks to continue, or for cancer to progress. And we have a technology, RNA interference, that can turn genes off, and it's quite effective. We send in little molecules of RNA, they latch onto the messenger RNA expressing a gene and turn it off, destroy it. We have new means of gene therapy that can add new genes. They put them in the right place, overcome some of the earlier problems with them ending up in the wrong chromosome. So we'll have not just designer babies, but designer baby boomers, which is something I'm personally more interested in. We can turn on and off the consequences of genes. For example, we can turn on and off enzymes, which is very often how genes express themselves. So Pfizer's torcetrapib turns off one specific enzyme at one specific point in time that's critical for atherosclerosis to continue. The phase 2 trials show that it stopped atherosclerosis, which is really dramatic. They're spending a record $1 billion on the phase 3 trials. And that's just one example of thousands of this rational drug design, where we can basically reprogram biology. And this is escalating exponentially, and it's a whole new paradigm. So you can't necessarily judge the ideas in, say, drug development based on the past, because 99% of the drugs were done this old way. Many other areas are being subject to this law of accelerating turns as different industries go from a pre-information era to a post-information era. I mean, even energy, that's clearly not an information technology today, but once we master nanotechnology, we'll be able to have nano-engineered solar panels that can capture enough sunlight to meet all of our energy needs, and I analyze that in my book, Singularity is Near. We only need to capture 1% of 1%, one part in 10,000 of the sunlight, to meet 100% of our energy needs. We can't do this today with these old industrial age solar panels, but there are new nano-engineered designs that could actually do that. There are actually quite a few venture-funded companies, maybe you're involved with some of them, that have a new generation of nano-engineered solar panels that really will make a difference over the next 5 or 6 years. But if you go out 20 years, I make the case that we will be able to meet 100% of our energy needs this way and then store the energy in decentralized nano-engineered fuel cells and really get away from fossil fuels. All this discussion about solar, about global warming, I mean, I look at all this literature, nanotechnology is not mentioned at all, as if it doesn't exist, as if 100 years from now we're still going to be doing the same old thing. It's very important to take the exponential progression in these technologies into account because they are disruptive, as you heard yesterday, and the pace of these disruptive changes is going to accelerate. Now, the pace of paradigm shift itself is growing exponentially. It's doubling every decade. While the power, price, performance, capacity, and bandwidth of information technology doubles even faster every year. We have hundreds of examples of this. These graphs, by the way, are logarithmic graphs, meaning as you go up the graph, it represents multiplying some feature by powers of 10. So a straight line on a logarithmic graph is exponential growth. So this is the adoption of the first virtual reality technology, the telephone, where you could actually be with someone else as if you were together, even if you were hundreds of miles apart, at least as far as talking is concerned. That's how they saw the telephone in the 19th century. I mean, before that, you actually had to be in the same place to hold a conversation. But that took half a century to be adopted by a mass audience, defined as a quarter of the U.S. population. The cell phone did that in 7 years. If we look at these different technologies, telephone, radio, television took decades to be adopted. PC, mobile phone, the web, were adopted by a quarter of the U.S. population in just a few years' time. And this is really a pervasive phenomenon, true of any evolutionary process. It's true of biological evolution, and it's true of technological evolution. This is a double logarithmic graph, so on the x-axis, it's how many years ago this paradigm shift took place in powers of 10, and on the y-axis, it's how long this paradigm shift took until the next paradigm shift. So the first paradigm shift in evolution, in basically the evolution of biology itself, the evolution of an information backbone to biology, DNA, actually RNA came first, that took billions of years. The reason that an evolutionary process accelerates is because it evolves a capability, and then it uses that capability to evolve the next stage. So the next stage goes more quickly, and the fruits, the products of that stage are exponentially more powerful. So the next stage, the Cambrian explosion, when all the body plans of the animals evolved, that went 100 times faster. It took only 10 million years. And then evolution adopted those body plans. They became a mature technology and evolved higher cognitive functions, and that only took millions of years. And then Homo sapiens, the first technology-creating species, evolved in only a few 100,000 years. And it's actually only three simple evolutionary changes, genetic changes, that distinguish us from our primate ancestors, comprising only a few tens of thousands of bytes of information. Very little information, genetic information, distinguish us, but it's those were the enabling factors for technology. Basically, a larger skull at the expense of a weaker jaw, so don't get into a biting contest with another primate. More of the brain was devoted to the cerebral cortex, so we could do more abstract reasoning. We could do what-if experiments in our mind. What if I took that stone and that stick and tied them together with that twine? I could actually extend my leverage. And then we could carry out those what-if experiments and actually change the world and create tools, because we had an opposable appendage that works. It might look like a chimpanzee's hand looks similar, but the pivot point is down 1 inch, and if you watch them, they're pretty clumsy. They don't have a power grip. They don't have fine motor coordination. They really couldn't manipulate the environment well enough to create technology. So those are the three enabling factors. And that brought in the next stage of really the increasing complexity on Earth, which was technological evolution. And that went a little bit faster. The first steps, stone tools, fire the wheel, took tens of thousands of years. And then we always use the latest technology to create the next. And so technology kept accelerating. It took a century for the printing press half a millennium ago to be adopted. Half a century ago, the first computers were actually designed pen on paper and wired with screwdrivers. And now we, of course, use computers and computer-assisted design software and create a new computer system in a matter of hours. And this is a straight line showing this continual acceleration on this double logarithmic graph. If we put the x-axis on a linear scale rather than a logarithmic one, it looks like everything has just happened on an evolutionary scale. Now, some people said, okay, Kurzweil will only put points on this graph if they fit on the straight line, and if there was a point that wasn't quite on the straight line, I didn't bother to include it. So I took 14 different lists from 14 different thinkers, Carl Sagan's Cosmic Calendar, the American Museum of Natural History, Encyclopedia Britannica, a dozen other lists, as to what these thinkers and reference works thought were the key events in biological and technological evolution. And there is some disagreement. Some people think the Cambrian explosion took 20 million years, and some people think the internet took 25 years, and this disagreement of when human language started. But you can see a clear trend line. Nobody thinks the internet took a million years. Nobody thinks the Cambrian explosion took 10 years. A billion years ago, not much happened in a million years. There's been a clear acceleration in both biological and technological evolution. And if we look, this is a linear graph, but it just shows a simple representation of a linear progression and an exponential one. It may seem obvious, most people do not consider exponential change in their intuitive grasp of the future. I think that's hardwired. We see what's in front of our face. We think in linear terms. We think the current pace will change. Very sophisticated people make this mistake all the time. I was at this conference at Time Magazine, organized on the 50th anniversary of the discovery of DNA, and all of us speakers were asked, okay, what will the next 50 years bring? Every one of the speakers there, except for myself and one other guy, Bill Joy, used the last 50 years as a model for the next 50 years, but that's clearly not correct. That's not consistent with history. So Watson himself, the co-discoverer of DNA, said, oh, in 50 years we'll have drugs that enable you to eat as much as you want and remain slim. And I said, Jim, we've already done that in animals, and these drugs are entering human trials. It's going to be 5 to 8 years, not 50 years. You could have said 500 years. You would have gotten the same very tame predictions. People are not able to really factor in the exponential pace of change. Most government models are based on linear extrapolations, and they work quite well for a year or 2 years, which is generally the planning horizon. They break down quite considerably when they start talking about 10, 20 years, and so when you have these discussions based on these linear models about what will happen to Social Security in 2042, based on totally inaccurate projections of things like longevity and or even what it means to be 65. If you've got 85-year-olds that are as fit as 35-year-olds, we'll have to rethink Social Security. But the exponential trends differ quite considerably. This is now fast enough that within the entrepreneurial planning horizon, say the venture capital cycle of 6 to 8 years, there's going to be several generations of technology. Things will be quite different. You really need to factor this into your business and technology plans. And the ongoing exponential growth of a technology occurs through multiple S-curves, each one representing a different paradigm. People say, well, Kurzweil ignores the fact that exponential growth can't go on forever, which is not the case. Rabbits in Australia, they grow exponentially, but then they hit a wall when they eat up all the foliage and the exponential growth stops. That's true of any specific paradigm. It'll have a certain ability to carry on exponential growth until it saturates. But what happens then is it creates research pressure for the next paradigm, and you get another S-curve and another spurt to the exponential growth. We've seen that 5 times already in the century-long history of computation. And as we get enough data, we see this ripple of different paradigms carrying on the exponential growth in different information technologies. Now, you might say, well, there must be some overall limit to the, based on physics, to the ability of matter and energy to support computation and communication, and that's true. There is a limit, but it's not very limiting. 1 cubic inch of nanotube circuitry would be 100 million times more powerful than the human brain, according to the most conservative estimates of the amount of computation required to simulate all several hundred brain regions. So there are limits, but they're not very limiting, and even that is not the ultimate limit based on what we know about the physics of computation. And I talk about that in quite a bit of detail in my book, Singularity is Near. Information technologies are doubling every year. Depending on what you measure, whether it's brain scanning resolution or the amount of data on the brain or the amount of genetic data or communication bandwidths, the number of bits moving around the internet, the number of web pages, I mean, these things are all doubling. It's 11 months, 12 months, 13 months, depending on what you're looking at. But generally, every year, we're doubling all these, 100 different measures of information technology in many different areas, and it's not just Moore's Law. When I was at MIT, a computer that took up about half the size of this room, it was MIT's computer and was shared by thousands of students, $11 million, at least 1,000 times less powerful than the computer in your cell phone today. But Moore's Law is just one example of many. I put 49 famous computers here on a logarithmic graph, going back to the first computer that was used in, or actually data processing equipment that was used in the 1890 census. Then there were telephone relays used to build computers. The English cracked the German Enigma code, and a lot of interesting literature about how the English tried to trick the Germans into thinking they got the information in some other way because they didn't want the Germans to know that they had cracked the code. 1950s, CBS predicted the election of Eisenhower with vacuum tube-based computers, the first time the American networks did that. Then there were shrinking vacuum tubes, making them smaller and smaller to keep this exponential growth growing, and that hit a wall. They got to a point where they couldn't shrink the vacuum, or couldn't shrink the tube and keep the vacuum, and that was the end of the shrinking of vacuum tubes. It was not the end of the exponential growth of computing. We then went on to the fourth paradigm, transistors, which are not small tubes. It's a whole different paradigm. And then we've had several decades of integrated circuits and Moore's Law shrinking the features on integrated circuits. And people have said, oh, well, that's going to come to an end. And it will, although there's been a lot of false predictions about that. The first predictions were 2002. Intel now says 2022. At that point, the key features, if you read the ITRS roadmap, which is a thick document describing the future of semiconductors, now goes out to 2019. It's been very accurate for decades now. And it predicts by 2018, the key features will be 4 nanometers. That's 20 carbon atoms. And we'll get around that time, around 2020, we won't be able to shrink them anymore. And that'll be the end of Moore's Law, which is the fifth paradigm. But there won't be the end of the exponential growth of computing. We'll go on to the sixth paradigm, which is using the third dimension. We live in a three-dimensional world. We might as well use the third dimension. Our brain uses 3 dimensions, although it actually uses a very cumbersome and slow, inefficient communication and computation mechanism. The inner neural connections computed 200 calculations per second. That's billions of times slower than today's computers. They send information using chemical signals, which travel a few hundred feet per second, which is a million times slower than electronics. But it gets its power from being organized in three dimensions and a high degree of parallelism. There's 100 trillion computers basically computing very slowly, but simultaneously in your brain. We will go to the third dimension. That'll be the sixth paradigm. And you'll notice that this is not a straight line, but another exponential, a slow exponential. We have exponential growth in the rate of exponential growth. There's a theoretical reason for that. As a technology gets more cost-effective, there's more money in R&D, so the pace of acceleration picks up. The computer industry was a handful of projects half a century ago. Now it's a multi-trillion dollar industry. It took us 3 years to double the price performance of computing in 1900, 2 years in 1950, and it's now 1 year. These are different computers, same progression. Supercomputers marching along exponentially. Now, you know, my predictions very often get a reaction that they're radically optimistic in terms of capability. They invariably turn out to be conservative by design. I predicted this emergence of this worldwide communication network in 95, 96. It happened in 93, 94. First reference of the World Wide Web in the New York Times was 1993. Predicted a computer would take the World Chess Championship in 1998 because I saw the chess machines growing exponentially. Kasparov was at, I made that prediction in the 80s. Kasparov, 93, was asked about that. He says, oh, it's not far from now. And he said, that's ridiculous. I've played the best chess machines in the world, and they're pathetic. They're brittle, predictable. And that was true in 1993. They soared past him in 97. And in the book that just came out 8 months ago, predicted that a computer would hit 10 of the 16th calculations per second, 10 million billion calculations per second. That's a significant number because that's my estimate of the amount of computation required to simulate all several hundred regions of the human brain, and I have four different ways of approaching that. 6 weeks after the book came out, Japan announced two supercomputer projects to hit that level in 2010, so I think that will end up being conservative as well. I don't want to dwell on all these examples of Moore's Law, but look at this chart here. I mean, this is the cost of a transistor. When I was a high school student growing up in Queens, New York, I used to hang out at the surplus electronics shops on Canal Street, and they're still there. And I'd buy something about this big, which was one telephone relay with support circuitry, equivalent to a transistor, only a lot slower, for about $40. And come 1968, you could buy a whole transistor faster than the relay for just $1. And 2002, you could get 10 million transistors for a dollar. Now it's 100 million. So that's pretty phenomenal progress. But the key point is look at how smooth this progression is. I mean, this looks like it's the output of some tabletop experiment. But this is the measure of the activity and progress of millions of people in thousands of companies and dozens of countries and accusations of countries dumping products in another and all kinds of the vagaries of human activity in recessions and wars. And out of all that unpredictable human behavior comes this very smooth, very predictable progression. And as we seek to predict different types of phenomena that have to do with information, they follow these very smooth progressions despite the unpredictableness of specific incidents in human history. And unlike Gertrude Stein's roses, it's not the case that a transistor is a transistor. As we've made them cheaper, they're actually better because they're smaller, the electrons have less distance to travel, and so they're exponentially faster. And so the cost of a transistor cycle has been coming down by half every 1.1 year. Add other types of innovation and you have a doubling of price performance every 1 year. That's 50% deflation in electronics. It also happens to be true of things like databases, data about the brain. Genetic data has been coming down by half every year. It was $10 to sequence a base pair of DNA in 1990. It's a penny today. All these different examples of information technology get cheaper by half, approximately, depending on what you're measuring. Deflation is approximately 50% in information technology. And information technology is already a sizable fraction of the world economy, and it will be most of the world economy by the 2020s. So depending on what week it is, the economists will worry about inflation or deflation. Bernanke at the Fed is back on inflation. although he was criticized recently by Alan Greenspan. And I had the opportunity to have dinner with Greenspan and told him my ideas about the deflationary influence of information technology. That's why we don't see rampant inflation, despite all these very aggressive inflationary pressures. I mean, energy and housing costs and all these things are inflationary, and yet we don't see much inflation. A few months ago, they were actually worried about deflation, and the economists will say, well, deflation's bad also. Because, I mean, yes, it's a good thing on the face of it that you can buy the same capability for half the money a year later, but people aren't going to actually increase their consumption that rapidly. They're not going to double their consumption every year, keep up with that. They'll increase somewhat, but then the size of the economy that has to do with information is going to shrink as measured in currency, and that's a bad thing. And when most of the economy is information technology, the whole economy will be shrinking. And that's bad for various reasons. That's actually not what we see. We see the consumption of every form of information technology more than doubles every year. People didn't spend $10,000 for an iPod 10 years ago. When the price performance reaches a certain level, whole new applications become cost-effective and explode on the landscape. We more than double our consumption. In fact, as measured in constant dollars, we've increased our consumption of information technology by 18% per year for the last 50 years. In fact, that is principally the only thing that's growing in the economy. That is the driver of economic growth. And as more and more of the economy becomes information technology, the growth rates are increasing. And we see that around the globe. We see growth rates in India and China of 8 or 9%. Even sub-Saharan Africa was 4.8% last year. The United States was over 4%. The growth rates are rising as information technology becomes a larger fraction. The non-information portions of the technology are shrinking. So magnetic data storage, I just put that up there because it's not Moore's Law, this is not transistors, it's magnetic spots, different engineers, different companies, same progressions. This is a basic phenomena that has to do with any form of information. And I mentioned the biotechnology revolution. This is a profound change in biology and medicine. We're going to be able to reprogram these information processes underlying biology. I mean, biology, genes, and their expression is basically an information process, and we're learning to master these, and that's progressing exponentially. It'll be a very different world 10 or 15 years from now. So DNA sequencing costs $10 in 1990, 2 cents in 2004. This slope on this log graph is a doubling every year. Actually, it's doubling every 10 months of the amount of genetic data we've sequenced, and this is true also of the proteome and every other aspect of biology. Communication technology, which many of you are involved with, many different ways to measure this, but we see exponential growth. Here's that graph. Actually, I had a little piece of this in the 1980s of what was then called the ARPANET. I was able to predict that this would be, you know, hundreds of millions of nodes come mid-1990s. If we look at this on a linear graph, it looks like this. This is the same data. And we live in a linear world. This is how we experience technology. But to the casual observer, it looked like the internet just came out of nowhere in the mid-1990s. But if you looked at the log, at the exponential progression, you could see it coming. And we should be seeing what's coming now because this exponential growth is getting to points where it's truly transformative. We're also shrinking technology at an exponential rate. If we're doubling information technology in terms of price, performance, capacity every year, that's multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years, a billion in 30 years. Because of the second level of exponential growth, it's actually 25 years. We're going to multiply the impact, the price, performance, and power of information technology by a billion in the next quarter century. While at the same time, we shrink the size of technology. Both electronic and mechanical technologies are shrinking at a rate of 100 per decade in 3D volume, according to my models. That's 100,000 in that 25-year time frame. And there's many different examples of that. These are actually illustrations from Eric Drexler's book, which have now been actually built and simulated, showing... and this thesis actually was 1986. It introduced the modern field of nanotechnology. It was a very controversial thesis. Nobody was actually willing to touch the thesis except for my mentor, Marvin Minsky. But in my book, I describe dozens of projects that are actually building tiny systems that are blood cell sized, that have nano features measured in a modest number of nanometers. One scientist actually cured type 1 diabetes in rats with a blood cell-sized device, putting tens of thousands of these in their bloodstream, lets insulin out in a controlled fashion through 7-nanometer pores, blocks antibodies, because type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. And this actually works, and they're gearing up for human trials. There's 4 major conferences on biomems, creating blood cell-sized devices that are nano-engineered. MIT and the University of Rochester have a little nano device that is actually quite complex. It's one of these projects is actually getting funding from your Deshpande Innovation Center. It can detect the antigen specific to a cancer cell, latch onto the cell, burrow inside the cell, detect that it's inside the cell, and then release toxins. So it's 4 different stages. It's a pretty intricate device, and this actually works in vitro. They're gearing up now for animal trials. So there are very sophisticated things done already with blood cell-sized devices. So when we talk about nanobots going inside the bloodstream, keeping you healthy, people say, oh, that's very futuristic. We're already doing very impressive experiments in animals today with 4 major conferences covering the hundreds of projects in this area. If you apply what's being done today, this billion-fold increase in the power of information technology, and nanotechnology is applying information to matter and energy, while we shrink the key features by 100,000 in 3D volume, you get some idea of the sophistication of these devices over the next quarter century. This is a design of a robotic red blood cell that's been designed on the West Coast by Rob Freitas. Red blood cells are actually pretty simple. We have reverse engineered red blood cells. We understand how they work. They store and release oxygen in a controlled manner. And it brings up an interesting observation about biology, which is biology is very intricate, but it's also very suboptimal. This biological process made various assumptions along the way which it got stuck with, like building everything out of proteins, which is a very limited class of materials. And we're finding that as we understand and reverse engineer the principles of operation of biology, we can rebuild these systems to be thousands of times more capable. And an analysis of these respiracytes, robotic red blood cells, indicate if you replace a portion of your blood cells with these robotic versions, you could do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath, or sit at the bottom of your pool for 4 hours. So, honey, I'm in the pool will take on a whole new meaning. He's designed a robotic white blood cell that can download software from the internet to combat specific pathogens. This is a 2020 circa concept, but he actually has a detailed design of it. And that's not so futuristic when you consider we already have devices, tiny devices we can put inside the human body and brain that download software from the outside. For example, there's a neural implant, a computer you can place inside your brain for Parkinson's patients, and it replaces the biological neurons that are destroyed by Parkinson's. The neurons in the vicinity now get signals from the computer, whereas they used to get signals from the biological neurons before they were destroyed. And this hybrid of biological and non-biological intelligence works just fine. And the latest generation of this neural implant allows you to download new software to your neural implant from outside the patient. And this is an FDA-approved device. Today, that has to be surgically implanted, but if you apply this, you know, billion-fold increase and 100,000-fold decrease in size over the next quarter century, ultimately we'll be sending intelligent computerized devices in through the bloodstream, through the capillaries, into the brain and also in the body to keep us healthy. And as I say, there's already impressive experiments in animals along those lines. If we project out this exponential growth of computing through the 21st century, I mentioned that supercomputers will hit 10 to the 16th calculations per second, enough to simulate all several hundred regions of the brain by 2010. $1,000 of computation will do that in 2020. And I would say that that is actually a mainstream view today, that, oh yes, there'll be plenty of computation, plenty of hardware in the 2020s to simulate the human brain. That was controversial when my 1999 book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, came out. That is very much a mainstream view today among people who have studied that. The controversial issue, or the more interesting issue, is will we have the software? Or will these just be very fast calculators? Will we understand how human intelligence works? How do we do pattern recognition, which is actually my field of interest? How do we do cognitive reasoning and so forth? We're making exponential progress in that as well. First of all, we're making exponential progress in getting the raw data. If I asked you to reverse engineer this thing, computer, and I gave you, here's a magnetic tool you could use, and you can see what's going on, you develop a very crude theory. Oh, when I'm storing something in a database, it seems to be something going on over here. That's a small exaggeration of the state of the art in brain scanning 5 years ago. And you've seen fMRI pictures, and when people are doing a certain task, it's activity in this region of the brain, and that doesn't really tell us how that region of the brain performs that function. If you're an electrical engineer, you'd say, no, I need to be able to probe individual signals at very high speed. And that has not been feasible up until a few years ago. There's been exponential progress. We're doubling the spatial resolution of brain scanning in 3D volume every year. I described several new technologies, one from the University of Pennsylvania, that can actually see individual interneural signals and see them signaling in real time for the first time. And we're actually seeing the brain create your thoughts and your thoughts create your brain for the first time. But then the issue comes up, can we actually, and this is all progressing exponentially, but can we actually make sense of this data? Maybe it's just too complex for us to understand. Doug Hofstadter says, well, maybe our brain is below that threshold needed to understand our brain. And if we were smarter and actually able to understand it, well, then necessarily our brain would be that much more complicated and we'd never catch up with it. And maybe that's a feature of complex systems. A complex system inherently can't be so complex as to understand its own complexity. That turns out not to be the case. As we're getting this data, we're actually able to understand it. There's 20 different regions out of the several hundred that exist that we have actually modeled in detail in mathematical formulas as to how these regions process information very precisely and simulate them. This is a dozen regions of the auditory cortex that have been simulated, and then they've applied sophisticated psychoacoustic tests to the simulation, and they get very similar results as applying those same tests to human auditory perception. Doesn't prove the model is perfect, but it does indicate that it's pretty accurate. We actually have a simulation of the cerebellum, which is a very sophisticated region of the brain. It's where we do our skill formation. It comprises more than half the neurons in the brain. And again, applying skill formation tasks and tests to the simulation get similar results to human skill formation. And it brings up another interesting question, which is, how complicated is the human brain? Well, if you look at a mature brain, it seems pretty complicated. I've estimated there's thousands of trillions of bytes of information to characterize the state of all the ion channels and neurotransmitters and nonlinearities in the human brain. Take the cerebellum, for example. The wiring of the cerebellum, it just seems infinitely complicated. It's not infinite, but there are trillions of complicated tangles of connections, and you'd say, well, how could I ever figure this out? We have figured it out, and it's actually not that complicated. There's only tens of thousands of bytes of information in the genome that describe the wiring of the cerebellum. The design of the human brain is a billion times simpler than the actual manifestation of the brain. How do we know that? Well, the design of the human brain is in the genome. The genome also has the design of the human body. And the genome doesn't have that much information in it. I mean, there's 3 billion rungs, that's 6 billion bits, which is 800 million bytes, but it's very sloppily coded. It's replete with redundancies. One sequence called ALU, which is a very lengthy sequence, is repeated in the genome 300,000 times. If you apply lossless compression to the genome using knowledge of its structure, you get 30 to 100 million bytes. It's probably closer to 30 million bytes. That's less than Microsoft Word. And my point is not that the brain is a simple system, but it's a level of complexity that we can manage. And take the cerebellum, for example. We have figured out how it's wired, even though it seems vastly complex. And I'll describe what the genome says about the cerebellum. It says there's four different types of neurons. There's one module is organized kind of like this. Now repeat that 10 billion times and add some random variation with each repetition within the following constraints. Okay, that's a summary of what the genome says about the cerebellum. And we actually understand that in detail and have been able to simulate it. To get an idea of how that works, I mean, you've all seen this image. It's the Mandelbrot set. It's very often cited as an example of complexity. In fact, it's on the cover of a book called Complexity, and it's a very complex image. How much information is in the Mandelbrot set? Well, it depends on what resolution to display it at, but it can be... it's not my computer. But I can keep talking while they reload it. The Mandelbrot set looks very complex. There are billions of bytes of information in a display of the Mandelbrot set. And as we zoom in on finer features, there's more and more complexity. But the design of the Mandelbrot set is much simpler. It's actually only 6 letters long. 6 letters describe the whole Mandelbrot set. And it's a fractal, so these 6 characters of information are displayed and then iteratively made more and more complex, and you get an image.
They're running off backup right now.
You get an image that ends up being highly complex. That actually describes the relationship quite well of the genome to the actual brain. The brain actually is a fractal. It's a probabilistic fractal. It has certain randomness built in. So there's actually relatively, like the cerebellum, it's only a few tens of thousands of bytes of information in the design. It's then manifested and iteratively applied with a certain amount of randomness, and you get these literally trillions of bytes of information represented in its final manifestation. We're making progress on reverse engineering the visual cortex. The early part of the visual cortex has now been reverse engineered, and apparently the early part of the visual cortex reduces these billions of bytes of information that we're getting from our eyes to very sparsely coded signals, 7 basically very low resolution movies, and that's all the rest of the brain actually gets. We actually hallucinate what we see from these very sparse signals that the early visual cortex releases. It's really quite interesting. So all of this is producing exponential gains in the economy. It is responsible for the exponential growth we've seen in the economy. Labor of every kind has been getting exponentially more effective. As measured in constant dollars, we've gone from $30 to $130 in 45 years, despite the fact that a dollar buys twice as much information technology each year. And the adoption of these technologies is also exponential. This is the adoption of e-commerce. It's now over $1 trillion, and it progressed exponentially. Now, you might say, now, wait a second. Wasn't there a boom and a bust in this dot-com phenomenon? That was just a Wall Street phenomenon. That was a capital markets phenomenon. The investment community looked at the internet and said, wow, this is going to change everything. This is going to change every business model. So all the dot-com values soared. And then they came back a few years later, about the year 2000, and said, it hasn't changed every business model. I guess we were wrong, and all the values went the other way. But actually, it was progressing exponentially. If you remember my linear graph of the internet, it looked like nothing was happening. It was growing exponentially, but nothing was happening year after year after year, and finally it took off. So yes, e-commerce was growing exponentially, but it was doubling very little numbers. And there wasn't a realistic appreciation of the timing in the investment community. This boom-bust psychology is very often a true harbinger of true revolutions. It happened in telecommunications, and it even happened with the railroads in the 1900s. So let me show you another example of technology we've put together. One of my companies developed the first large vocabulary speech recognition that was commercially marketed, and another one of my companies in the 1970s developed the first speech synthesis. So we put contemporary versions of our products together with language translation. That's actually come a long way. Actually, through the power of data mining and these very large databases, we're actually able to do some very impressive work applying pattern recognition to language translation. I was at Google recently, and they showed me an English to Arabic and Arabic to English translator, basically applying pattern recognition to these very extensive databases they have of Rosetta Stone text with translated text from English and Arabic. And the resulting system compared equally to human professional translators, but no one on the team that created the system spoke a word of Arabic. It shows the power of pattern recognition. And in our speech recognition, we did the same thing. We didn't tell the system there are 44 phonemes and this is how they're structured. We let the system find these rules on its own from very large databases. So I put together a translating telephone. I've actually used this to communicate with other people. This will lead to an even flatter world when we can communicate with each other. I talked English. This woman in Germany heard me in German. She spoke German. I heard her in English. And we were able to understand each other just fine, because people misunderstand each other even if they're speaking the same language. So. This will be a routine feature of your cell phone in early in the next decade.
This is a demonstration, comma.
Dies ist eine Demonstration.
Of a prototype of a quote translating end quote telephone. Period.
Von einem Prototyp eines übersetzenden Telefons.
Within a few years, comma.
Innerhalb einiger Jahre.
We will be able to talk to anyone, comma.
Wir werden fähig sein, zu jemandem zu reden.
Regardless of their language, period.
Ohne Rücksicht auf ihre Sprache.
The rain in Spain, comma.
La pluie en Espagne
stays mainly in the plain, period.
Reste dans la plaine principalement.
Merci pour votre attention, period.
Thank you for your attention.
Excuse my French. We will solve this problem that people like large displays. So these 5-foot high definition screens are very popular, but we also want devices that are even smaller than this. The answer to that is to put the devices right in your eyeglasses and beam very high resolution images right into your retina. I'm on the Army Science Advisory Board here in the United States, and they have these full immersion systems where you can put a soldier in a full immersion virtual reality system, and it feels like they're in the weapon, but actually they could be hundreds of miles away. The Arm Predator was an early example of that. Surgeons can be in a virtual reality environment, so if they're operating in the eye, which is, of course, very small, they can feel like they're in an eye this big and then perform surgical maneuvers, and it's translated into fine movements of a robotic surgeon. But we will routinely be in full immersion virtual reality, visual auditory environments early in the next decade. We'll be interacting with virtual personalities. It'll have a sufficient command of natural language to perform routine functions. We'll have language translation. We'll have augmented reality. So as we look at the world, we'll have pop-up displays telling you what's in that building or reminding you it's that person's birthday or telling you what person's name is. That'll be helpful. If we go out to 2029, it's when these trends will really get traction. It's a billion-fold increase over today's price performance and capacity and bandwidth of information technology. We'll have completed the reverse engineering of the human brain. We'll have detailed mathematical models and simulations of all several hundred regions. Non-biological intelligence will pass the Turing test, passing for human intelligence. Non-biological intelligence will combine the subtle features of human pattern recognition with ways in which machines are already superior. I mean, that, well, it's no longer there, but $1,000 of computation can remember billions of things accurately. It can share information at electronic speeds. Even a mathematician can't hold up to Mathematica running on a $1,000 PC. It'll be a very powerful combination, but it's not an alien invasion of intelligent machines come to compete with us. It's going to increase our own reach and intellectual grasp. It's doing that already. I mean, we routinely do intellectual feats that would be impossible without our machines. Very few professionals could do their jobs altogether without computers. You know, search engines are already memory prosthetics. This is getting closer and closer. It literally will be going inside our human brain and body, keeping us healthy, extending our mental reach. One application, for example, full immersion virtual reality from within the nervous system. You want to go in virtual reality, the nanobots shut down the signals coming from your real senses, replace them with the signals that your brain would be receiving if you were in the virtual environment, and then your brain feels like it's in that virtual environment. And this can be full immersion, highly realistic, high resolution. You can go there by yourself or with other people. And it'll be just like being there, but you'll have millions of new virtual reality environments to choose from. But mostly it's going to be an expansion of human intelligence. Our computers, even though most of them are not yet inside our brains and bodies, although a few of them are already expanding the intelligence and reach of the human species. That's what the human species is all about. People say, well, isn't this going to change the nature of what it is to be human? Well, the nature of what it is to be human is to go beyond our limitations. We didn't stay in the ground. We didn't stay in the planet. We didn't stay with the limitations of our biology. It is the one unique feature about the human species is that we go beyond our limitations. And I'll leave you with one last thought, which is that's also true of our longevity. It was not in the interest of the human species when our genes were evolving for people to live past child-rearing, and that generally meant age 26. So human life expectancy was in the 20s 1,000 years ago. It was 37 in 1800. That's only 200 years ago. Schubert and Mozart died in their 30s. That was typical. There was no sanitation, so there were lots of bacterial infections. There were no antibiotics, or bacterial infection was a disaster for the individual and for the family because there were no social safety nets, etc., etc. Thomas Hobbes described human life quite well as short and brutish and disaster-prone and disease-filled and poverty-filled a few hundred years ago. We've made a lot of progress. And when we get to a point where we get real traction with biotechnology and we can reprogram the information processes underlying biology, according to my models, within 10 to 15 years, we'll be adding more than a year every year to remaining life expectancy, not infant life expectancy. So your remaining life expectancy will expand more than a year every year. So as you go forward a year, your life expectancy will move on away from you. So if you can hang in there for another decade or so, we may get to experience the remarkable century ahead. Thank you very much.